You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, candy one, candy one. Many stones can form an arch, singly none.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Jen Zaman, and I am in for the absent Judy Ansel. She is on assignment this week. And our show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and IBEW Local 124. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. IBEW Local 124 has proudly served Kansas City's electrical construction since 1905. Our cause is the cause of human justice, human rights, and human security. On tonight's show, we are going to look at two successful citizen campaigns in Kansas City. First, in the wake of BNIM's withdrawal from the Crossroads Project, we will look into the pros and cons of tax increment financing. It is called TIFF, Arrested Development. Next, in Honeywell Not Well, we'll ask how workers and local activists finally got public and government attention to the toxic health impact of Kansas City's nuclear weapons plant. In the news, Kansas and Missouri legislatures outdo each other in obliterating workers' rights, and new study shows that fewer patients die when doctors strike. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. And now for the news.
Now the news from our side, February 11th, 2015. As the 2016 presidential election nears, Kansas City fast food, child care, and home health care workers are registering to vote for $15 minimum wage. Well, not exactly, but the message they are giving to candidates is, we're registering to vote, some of us for the first time ever, and we want to know if we can count, we can vote for you. Today, a group of low-wage workers from Stand Up KC, along with allies from the faith community, held a press conference in front of the Kansas City Board of Elections to announce that as the fight for 15 continues to grow, they pledge to use their momentum to elect leaders who support higher pay and better jobs. They demand that all candidates who want their vote need to support $15 in a union, rights for fast food, child care, and home care, and all underpaid workers, and support immigration reform and racial equality. Last month, a bus full of Stand Up KC members and allies went to Des Moines to deliver the same message. Heartland Labor Forum's Tino Scalisi was there with a contingent of auto workers. He reported that on January 28th, Des Moines had its first ever fast food strike. Afterwards, there was a rally of 1,000 people. Wendy's worker Wiley King told the Des Moines Register, "We're going to support the candidate that supports us. We are the people, and we deserve the American dream."
In Missouri, Republicans are at it again, trying to repeal the state's prevailing wage law. The law ensures fair wages on state and local public construction projects. Under existing law, the base wage is set annually for a variety of jobs. It is calculated using what workers are actually earning. But under House Bill 1931, sponsored by Representative Warren Love, Republican from Osceola, contractors could pay skilled construction workers as little as minimum wage. Democrat John Carpenter from Gladstone disagrees. He said that states without a prevailing wage are among the country's poorest and least educated. No action was taken on the bill Monday. The House passed a similar measure in 2013, but it died in the Senate.
Not to be outdone in attacking working people, the Kansas legislature is considering a bill that would strip community technical college teachers of their rights to a disciplinary hearing before being dismissed. If passed, this bill would essentially eliminate tenure. On Tuesday, the House Education Committee held a hearing on the bill. The Kansas legislature did the same thing to K-12 teachers 2 years ago. Now teachers are leaving the state. Melanie Harvey, who teaches chemistry at Johnson County Community College, testified that due process gives us the freedom to speak up without a dissenting voice, without fear of retaliation. Deborah Williams, who teaches environmental science at JCCC, said the current system has encouraged innovative instruction and a secure work environment. This is a bill in search of a problem, Williams said. There's really nothing to fix. Vince Clark, a JCC history professor, said that the loss of due process would make it more difficult to attract and retain faculty. Administrators saw it differently. Greg Good of the Kansas Association of Technical Colleges complained that it's difficult and expensive to remove a faculty member gone bad. It can take 2 years. Meanwhile, students have to put up with it. Herb Swindler, president of Gordon City Community College, said that rather than encouraging innovation, the current system encourages complacency. Instructors, after their third year, have less incentive to excel. He said it's not about academic freedom and asked why faculty should have more protection than other workers.
A recent article in the Boston Globe discussed research finding that when doctors go on strike, outcomes for patients often improve. While that might seem counterintuitive, there is data to support the suggestion. Ryan Hoskins uncovered a 2008 analysis led by Solvig Cunningham of Emory University, which attempted to bring together existing research on physician strikes to see whether patterns existed on patient impact. Five strikes, lasting from 9 days to 5 weeks in places as varied as Los Angeles, Jerusalem, twice, Spain, and Croatia, yielded sufficient data to study. Researchers found that mortality in all cases either stayed the same or substantially declined when physicians walked out. In the case of the first Israeli strike of 1973, patient deaths dropped by 50%. The authors acknowledge a number of potential flaws in the review. The first is that none of these strikes did medical care cease completely. Emergency services were always made available. What's more, some high-risk patients may have sought care elsewhere during the work stoppages, relieving the system of cases more likely to end up dying. Hoskins says that researchers surmise that when doctors are on strike, fewer optional procedures are performed and doctors perform fewer operations overall. Another important finding he discovered is that when nurses go on strike, the overall health of patients decline. A 2012 study by MIT's Jonathan Gruber examined nurses' walkouts in New York State from 1984 to 2004. He found that patients admitted on days of labor actions had death rates 18.3% above normal. It's a reassuring indicator that nurses, more involved in bedside care and less involved in treatment plans, actually improve patient outcomes when staffed appropriately. This is good news for nurses because it adds incentive for hospitals to negotiate an end to their strikes. The news tonight was read by Sean Saving, Molly Madden, Michael Savoie, and myself, Ariana Eckel.
Does anyone remember the days with full John L? It's thanks to him no child of mine will know the breaker's hell. Tell me, which side are you on?
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 Which side?
All right, tonight we're going to talk about the TIF, and hopefully by the end of the program we will have a better understanding of what really is the meaning of the concept of the tax incentive funding. We have Terry Ward as our guest, and Sean Savings is also here. So could you talk about your background, why I wanted you here?
Sure, Lon. I'm glad to do that. I've been involved with TIFs for almost 20 years in some form or another. I represent the North Kansas City School District on the Kansas City TIF Commission, and have done that for almost 20 years. About in 1990, I actually put together a TIF that was successfully approved and served very well to support neighborhoods and to create some wonderful opportunities. And then most recently, I am a professor at Park, but while I was working on my doctoral dissertation, my topic was the impact of TIFs on public education. And I continue to do research in my new role on the faculty at Park University.
Okay. Do you have a question?
Well, yeah. So let's just talk about what a TIF is. Let's just start from the very basics, considering that maybe a lot of people, we've heard about them. We know they're somehow they involve taxes being given away or something to developers, and they're very controversial. So could you explain what does a TIF stand for? It's TIF, Tax Increment Financing. And how does it work?
Okay, let me answer your question. Let me pause 1 second, though, and offer the real part of the issue is not only TIF. There is a range of economic development incentives. TIF is one, and it's one that's widely used. There are other incentives that involve involve abatement. One of the things that's different about TIF, it involves the collection of taxes and then their diversion to fulfill the plan that was approved. The idea is that the increment, those new taxes created because of the increased assessed valuation created by new construction, would normally flow to taxing jurisdictions like schools, libraries, health departments, senior citizens programs. With the approval of a TIF plan, which is presented by a developer wanting to do this, that increment, that new tax is collected by the county collector, but held in a separate account at the TIF Commission for the purpose of doing those things that the developer said had to be funded or he could not proceed with his project.
Right. The but-for.
The but-for test, which is a test that has to be demonstrated that says, but for the granting of this tax consideration, the project would not proceed.
Okay.
There's a question here. What's the criteria used to find TIF districts? In other words, how do they do this? How do they figure out it should go here or there?
Well, it's not defined by somebody externally. What starts is a developer who says, I want to build a project. Here's the project I want to build. Here's the geographic boundaries of the project I want to build. So the developer applies for approval as a TIF developer for a specific project at a specific location with a specific meets and bounds description of the property.
Well, doesn't there a definition of blight for a neighborhood or something that comes into play in the statute?
Yes, it does, but first the developer has to apply. Okay. And then two of the tests that he has to meet, he or she has to meet, one of them is a blight, demonstrate blight exists, and then the second one is to meet the but-for test.
Okay.
So those are demonstrations that the developer has to make and that the board of the TIF Commission and ultimately the City Council has to concur.
And that blight thing seems to be one of the areas of contention because, you know, TIFs have gone into the plaza. Arguably, some of the TIFs downtown 15 years ago, parts of downtown were probably, you could say, was blighted. A lot of people look and see a TIF on the plaza and go, how do you say that's a blighted area? And then we look at parts of the city that are blighted, and then we see no TIF at all there. So how is that blighted designation seems a little loose.
Well, it is broadly defined, and what it includes, and it's been expanded and expanded to where it is not generally a difficult test to meet. The base is exactly the kind of blight that you or I, either one, would see and say, yeah, that's blighted. Mm-hmm. But it also goes as far as to be a economic blight, which can be demonstrated by the fact that a greater tax would be created if this project is built and it's therefore not producing what it could, and that's considered economic blight. That's a definition that's been developed, and one of them is also a conservation district where you would do perhaps a larger district and say, to preserve this neighborhood, we need the TIF. So those are all definitions. Hmm. Now, the second point you raised was one about why don't TIFs happen in areas where there is blight that most of us walking down the street would say that's blighted? The key at this point is that TIFs are created by developers, are created in response to a request by a developer. And some of the areas that you're talking about, there's no developer trying to build something there. And so that's really the hang-up, where there are those who advocate, why don't we have TIFs coming in various parts of the city where there is blight? There's no prohibition within the TIF commission or the city council, and in fact, they probably would be delighted to have one. But again, it starts with a petition by a developer wanting to do a project.
Well, with that, say now the TIF is given out, what is the breakdown of the tax revenue lost to using TIF for development, and what areas are affected, and by how much percentage-wise? In other words, I know schools don't get anything, right?
Well, in a TIF plan, in a normal TIF plan,
right,
and you know, there's variations all over the place, but let me just say kind of generically, a normal TIF plan would have a 100% impact on the incremental property taxes and a 50% impact on the incremental EATs, which are the economic activity taxes, which are really sales taxes, earnings taxes, and some of the taxes we have that we've put on for hotels and restaurants. Okay. So what you've got is so if you think about it, most of us just paid a month ago our property tax. When you get your property tax bill, listed on it are 8 or 10 people that are dependent on that property tax. Schools being one, libraries being one, health departments, senior programs, in Clay County, the sheltered workshop, all of those things. The school districts generally draw 50 to 70% of their revenue from local property taxes. So they're losing that. If you look at a library, the two library systems here are 95% dependent on property taxes. If you look at the sheltered workshop, it's 99% dependent on property taxes. So depending on where you are and what your makeup is, it has different impacts. In schools, about 70% of their total revenue comes locally. So you're taking that's what you're attacking, is that 70%. Now, when you look at the EATS side of it, that means that, for instance, the city will have half of the sales taxes and earnings taxes collected, put into the TIF pool, and half of them will immediately start flowing into the general revenue of the city, so the city gets revenue starting as soon as there is an increment created.
And I think that leads me to my next question about how TIF is controlled, the entities that run this, that approve TIFs, how they get approved by the TIF Commission and the City Council, because it seems that there's an incentive. So your county, who gets property taxes, your school districts, your libraries, who funded off of property taxes, are giving up 100% of any new income that could come in from the project, whereas the city is only giving up 50% of any new taxes it gets, because the city gets the sales taxes and
earnings taxes.
In Kansas City, Missouri, the earnings tax. So the city has a vested interest in seeing this project go through, because they're still going to get some money out of the project, whereas schools and libraries don't get any benefit from the project. Directly monetarily. You know, there may be some other secondary, tertiary impact, but I mean, they don't see any new money. So, from that perspective, I think it's interesting to look at how the TIF Commission is formed and who sits on the TIF Commission in Kansas City, Missouri, and how many seats are controlled by the mayor's office and how many are appointees of the school board or the library district. So, could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, be glad to. For the It's by Missouri statute, so there's nothing determined locally in this. So the statute requires or provides that there are 11 TIF commissioners, and that's made up of six appointed by the mayor. If it's a city TIF commission, there can be a county one.
Okay.
But the ones that we're most familiar with right now are city ones. So the chief elected official in the city appoints the six commissioners that are there. Two are reserved for the largest taxing jurisdiction outside the city, which I'm not aware of any case that isn't the school district. So two for the school district, two for the county, and one for the other taxing jurisdictions. So the library and the health department and everybody has to collaborate and decide, okay, who's our one representative? The net of it is, out of the 11 commissioners, six are appointed by the mayor. Five are appointed to represent other taxing jurisdictions who usually will be the ones who have the they generally have more diverted into the
More at stake.
Into the TIF than the city does, usually.
And I think that leads to some of what happened with BNIM with that one commissioner who voted against the plan and then was subsequently made to resign like a week later.
Right. And now that is what I want to ask is, you said that the mayor gets a letter of resignation from everyone that he puts on. Does that go with everybody?
No. You are appointed by somebody, and based on how you're appointed, that determines whether there are any, I'm going to call it, other considerations that go in with it. No, I'm not aware of anyone else that has other considerations.
In other words, the mayor can say you resign because obviously he's already got your letter. If that wants you off the commission,
it's my understanding that that's the current practice.
Oh, okay, I was just curious about that.
Well, yeah, it seems that seems to be the story that happened with last fall. Did I guess my question then is do well? I guess there's a question. I understand in North Kansas City that they do things a little differently sometimes. Like they've negotiated deals where the school districts and the libraries still get 50%, or they don't give away the entire bank here.
Right.
And that's just, I guess, up to the local division to decide.
The 100% on the property tax and the 50%, which can be all the way to 100% on a super TIF, but those are all negotiable. That all can be done in the Northland. Generally, we are able to sit down. We know the developers. The developers are local. They're not out-of-town people. They have a vested interest in quality schools. They're very concerned about libraries. They're worried about, you know, the other people dependent on the services, and they rely on that to do their development. And because the school district has been working directly with these developers for 20 years with some fairly good continuity of relationship, we have a relationship we can build on, and the developers do come to us before it ever gets to the TIF commission. And so we have the opportunity to look at the deal, to look at what's there, to look at what's trying to be done. And we've generally been able to find an accommodation, so by the time the developer goes to the TIF commission, they can go with the support of the taxing jurisdictions, which makes the whole process flow better. And part of what happens is that it usually isn't 100% flat TIF. And I've seen different deals put together depending on what the developer is trying to do and what the taxing jurisdictions and how they want to work together.
Is there any way that Kansas City could get a commission or some way to get developers involved so that they could push them to go in and try to TIF, say with a blighted area or something like that, like a neighborhood association or something like that? Has that been done, is what I was just curious.
There have been times when certain times at various points in the TIF, in the with the TIF Commission and its staff over the last 20 years where, since the TIF is part of the Economic Development Council and the EDC is about bringing businesses to town, there are times when the EDC has recruited developers for specific projects. Okay. And some of them have been successful.
Well, and then could it negotiate it like you said?
It could certainly be negotiated.
What's your feeling on why the Kansas City, Missouri's TIF Commission seems to have not able to negotiate this sort of more balanced approach between its city each tax versus the school, library, other taxes that are...
Well, I mean, understand, when I talk about the North Kansas City School District, I'm talking about the Kansas City TIF Commission.
Sure.
So it isn't the...
Okay, right, right.
So it's there. It's available. The question is, comes down to more, what are the relationships between the developers and the taxing jurisdictions? And... the taxing jurisdictions haven't had negotiators in place for 20 years. Mm. And the developers, many are from out of town. And so it's a very different relationship. It's one of the developer stating how much money they want.
Yep.
And having limited concern for how much impact, adverse impact it has on other taxing jurisdictions. They tend to be driven more by the financial pro forma they're trying to operate under.
Do you know of any or success with a TIF that had brought in employment and other things to the city that could be used as a model for what we're doing?
I mean, yes. There are TIFs that have worked exquisitely well. The one that was terminated earlier this week did bring, a federal courthouse, did bring federal employment to the Civic Mall. The H&R Block TIF that was done in 1990, Block doubled the size of their corporate office, and it produced almost $2 million in neighborhood improvements controlled by the neighborhood. And there are more. I can go on with a lot.
Right.
It has done. There are ones that have done exactly what they laid out to do.
3 minutes. Okay. I guess that's one of my questions. Is a lot of the TIFs, I mean, particularly, I think there are TIFs that seem to just be shifting businesses around the city. I mean, we've obviously got the problem with the state. Missouri and Kansas try to steal jobs and businesses from each other, which is, maybe great for some governor's numbers or something, but it doesn't really do much for the overall economy of the city. But within the city itself, it seems there have been a number of projects where really all we've done is moved them from somewhere out, farther out, down to the downtown region, and then we've given up a bunch of tax money. But those employees were still working inside the city limits in the first place. So I guess I wonder how those are justified.
Well, let me go to your first comment, which is the state difference between Missouri and Kansas. Mm-hmm. What we are in Kansas, it's not as obvious because it's not done locally. It's done with state tax credits and state things. Mm-hmm. It's still happening. They're doing it. The net of all of that is there isn't an increase necessarily in employment. There is a reduction in taxes. So overall, what we're doing is defunding public services through the border war. But to go to moving around, not generally the case. Retail is usually a bad deal unless the objective is to concentrate retail, and you recognize by providing funding you can concentrate retail and make some things happen. So for that purpose, it works. If your goal is bringing new jobs, it isn't. You're moving them around. But what you're doing is moving them around. If your goal is movement, it works. If your goal is increased employment, it does not.
What could a group of citizens do to help move that in that kind of direction so everybody knows what's going on? Until this big movement on BNIM, there wasn't this outcry that we need to do something about it. And so how does that work?
Well, this is citizen involvement. And it's been going on there. The taxing jurisdictions have been involved. I personally have been involved in three different mayor-sponsored studies, which at the end were swamped by other interests that were pro-development.
Okay.
And so it's been going on. The difference is in this one, there was a grassroots uprising, I guess I'll call it for lack of a better term, to say, wait a minute, it's not just the five people sitting on the tax on the TIF commission that object. There are hundreds of us that think this is getting out of whack.
Well, I this has been really informative. It was a great discussion of the basics for TIF. I hope our listeners have learned a lot here. I know I have.
Well, really appreciate it, Terry Ward. I am glad you came. And I think we did solve that TIF idea, what it's about and how it works.
You're very
welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon Broadcast, a national town hall discussion on poverty and homelessness in America.
I wish they would do something about getting people off the streets.
And we need housing that people can afford.
Homeless people deserve housing, not shelters.
This year we'll be live from the streets of Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, where we will be speaking with homeless people, and we want to hear from you. What can this country do to end homelessness?
I think it would be pretty startling for the majority of the public to know that within about two blocks from the White House itself, there are homeless people sleeping in parks.
What we got here is a problem of human beings being treated like refuse.
I'm not giving up, and I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me.
That's the Homelessness Marathon Broadcast, coming to you soon and heard right here on
KKFI from 6 p.m. Wednesday, February 17th, till 8 a.m. Thursday, February 18th.
Madden, and I have Ann Salentrop here today. She's the project director for the Kansas City branch of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and she's a hard-working RN. According to the Kansas City Star, thousands of workers at the nuclear weapons plant were exposed to many dangerous products. That's all around the United States in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even in the 90s. But we're never warned of the danger. The front page article in the Kansas City Star on Sunday, December 13, 2015, concentrated on the Bannister Complex. That's the complex that starts at Troost and goes eastward on Bannister. They have a picture of a 58-year-old roofer who worked only 5 months at the complex and has chronic beryllium disease, a serious respiratory disease that can be fatal. He had asked for a protective suit, but was given a dust mask. Now, he would gladly give his $150,000 back if he could have his health. And in this article, it was mentioned that in a recent investigation by the federal government that some employees may have been exposed to more radiation than previously known. Is this due to the work of folks like Maurice Copeland and yourself who contacted outside medical personnel and lawyers?
Yes, I believe that we helped to raise the issues in the press and with various agencies, federal agencies. I'm on the board of the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, and that's an organization that has over 30 organizations locally at the sites of nuclear weapons production nationwide. And Maurice Copeland and I got together and started working on these issues I think it was the year 2008, 2009. We were, able to go to Washington, D.C. to lobby. ANA has D.C. days every spring. And the problem is that all this started, in the 40s as a very big secret. It's a secret enterprise. It's been that way from the start. People that worked in these institutions were even kept secret apart from one another. So the records aren't there to prove all this damage that was done to the workers. They have trouble getting hold of the records to prove what they were exposed to. They weren't warned about it. And in many cases, they didn't know what they were even dealing with. So how are they going to be able to prove that they were damaged by this? And then the federal government has always tried to maintain various people in the that stand to benefit from these enterprises. They try to downplay the danger of radiation. Oh, it's really not that hazardous. And there have been researchers that have proven that any amount of radiation is hazardous.
It seems like the Cold War workers everywhere were not protected. None of the people in the 50s, 60s, 70s wore a radiation badge or had a dosimeter to check this exposure unless the government was coming to inspect the plant. That's what I saw in the movie.
Yes, in the ANA, we hear stories from all over the complex, all over the different factories that are part of making nuclear weapons. There was a lot of, mining uranium, refining it, production of parts. Here in Kansas City, we make 85% of the parts for nuclear weapons since 1949 here. And we have a lot of weapons around in the ground or bombs that are ready to be dropped or carried on submarines. And they are also polluting and hazardous. And then we have the waste that has to be dealt with afterward. So it's like a vast network that is poisoning and destroying our environment and killing workers and downwinders, such as people that live near the Nevada test site. So it's just a huge, huge can of worms. It's a dirty, dangerous, and expensive enterprise. And it's also useless because we don't want to use nuclear weapons. We want to live. So, we've had 120 protests out at the new nuclear bomb plant to say, we need to stop this and we need to do something else. We need good paying jobs, yes, but we need jobs that are useful. Like, why can't we make solar panels? Why can't we make, something that's going to benefit us, like wind turbines? That we had a fall meeting here, the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, this past fall, and we had workers from the Kansas City plant present. Maurice Copeland was there, and they talked about the damage that was done. But then we also had people from St. Louis, and they talked about the radiation that was dumped in the neighborhoods in St. Louis before very many people moved to these areas. But now, suddenly they find out there's this dump of radioactive materials right, a mile or two away from their house. And yeah, this was from the very beginning of the Manhattan Project. They made the uranium that was set off the first reaction in Chicago, the very first nuclear reaction. And it also made materials for, I think it was the bomb in Nagasaki. I don't think it was the Hiroshima one.
So, in St. Louis.
Yes. And so this contaminated people in the past when they didn't really have a lot of knowledge, so to speak. And then it's doing it even today, and it will continue into future generations.
Was this covered by the movie The Safe Side of the Fence?
Yes.
Produced by Tony West.
Yes,
that was an eye-opener.
Yes, mm-hmm. And so that is still going on today. There's a underground fire in a nearby dump that is approaching the nuclear material. And so they suddenly found out about it because the schools sent home a memo to people of, oh, if that happens, if there's a huge explosion, we'll have your kids stay at school and shelter in until it's safe to come out and breathe the air. And people just went nuts. So there's a group of St. Louis moms that have started a Facebook page, and it went overnight, like in a matter of a few days, from 1,000 people or so to 18,000 people. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the Attorney General of Missouri is suing the dump.
Now, they were cleaning up a dump in the movie. There were barrels of hazardous material that were leaching out of these. There was all kinds of toxic substances in that dump. Is that the dump that you're talking about?
Well, there's the West Lake dump, but there are several areas around St. Louis that are involved. It's not just one spot.
Oh, yeah. I see. Mm-hmm. I see. And they talked to a worker in the movie. His nose was bleeding all the time, and they told him that he was on the safe side of the fence or something. The title of the movie was The Safe Side of the Fence, and it was really crazy because they had a wire fence blocking off all this horrible toxic barrels. And it, like, you couldn't smell it on the other side of the fence, you know?
It's just ridiculous. And there's a cancer cluster and autoimmune disease cluster in these contaminated areas. Mm-hmm. There's Coldwater Creek, Laddie Avenue, West Lake Landfill. There was a quarry that things got dumped into. And things like that happen here in Kansas City, too.
I do want to mention Tony's movie, Tony West, and I don't think he'll mind. I'll give you his home number if you're interested in the movie. It's 636-861-0944. Tony West, he produced this movie, young African-American young man, and because I'm sure the neighborhood was predominantly African-American, that might have interested him, mm-hmm. because they always put a dump in the poor areas of the sea. Yeah.
And for example, the mining of uranium was done in the Navajo Nation and the Lakota Nation in South Dakota. Mm. So they have a very high cancer rate now because those mines were not sealed up properly, and the wind just blows the radioactivity all over the place. But here in Kansas City, the chemicals are the problem. There's a huge pool underneath the plant. I don't know, it's 30, 40, 50 feet under the plant. And there's a few wells that pump and treat the VOCs and the PCBs down there. And those things, they'll kill you. I mean, it won't be fast like a bullet, but eventually, if you're in contact with that, it will kill you.
Now, does that leak into the Little Blue?
Yes, it does.
Oh,
yes. The Indian Creek and Little Blue rivers go right by the plant, and it is in a 500-year floodplain. There's floodgates around the plant.
In Kansas City, we'll leave St. Louis there for a minute, the Department of Labor lists 2,498 toxic substances that were used at the Bannister Complex since 1949. This includes PCBs, beryllium, asbestos, mercury, lead, and depleted uranium, and many more. When you went there, they started off with how many did they admit to?
In the first years when we were working on this, was about 300 or a few hundred chemicals were listed on the site. Then when we started getting arrested out there, we've been arrested about 120 times at the new plant, the old and new plant, trying to draw attention to this. And then it went up to about 800 or 900. And now, when this article came out that the McClatchy group published, I was like amazed. It was like over 2,000, almost 2,500.
Right, 2,498.
It's like, it's back to that old secrecy again, or poor record keeping, or whatever. You just need to keep digging at the truth and bringing it out into the light of day.
And it seems very frustrating because I only went to a couple meetings, but there are a number of people whose parents have already died, who, you know, they worked in the plant, and they never got a settlement, and their survivors may or may not get a settlement. And it said that more than half the cases of people who file cases, the settlements go to the survivors after the workers die.
That's such a shame, because it's like they keep putting them through this bureaucratic red tape, and you know, they want this form and that form filled out, and they deny, and then they die. And that's very common all over the United States. This is the complaint. And the officials don't seem to be too sympathetic either. I know one worker at the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. We were talking to him a couple years ago, and they're supposed to be the regulatory agency, right, to make sure they clean up the plant. And he just offhandedly mentioned the bogus claims of the workers at the Kansas City plant.
Bogus,
I was just appalled.
Now, there's a picture of a son, Otha Gilliam, and his mom and father died of cancer. And I think he was at the meeting, and they had died of pancreatic cancer. A lawyer said, no, if they had had kidney cancer, this might have been gone faster. But since they had pancreatic cancer, it's going to take longer. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
And,
to me.
You know, the thing is, there's never been a full-blown epidemiological study to thoroughly research how many people have died, how many people have gotten these weird cancers. The people that have come forward are just self-reporting. It's just the tip of the iceberg. There was 9,000 people that worked there at the height of the plant functioning, and because we used to have about 70,000 nukes in the whole world. Now we have about 16,000. So we're getting rid of them. It's a dying enterprise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not probably...
And they're hoping never to use them.
Right.
Right.
Or ridiculous. And then there's the subcontractors, the contractors, people that came on site to do repairs on the roof, like this guy in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
People that made deliveries there, were in and out. You know, and then not to mention the people on the other side of Bannister Federal Complex, the GSA workers, who did not have anything to do with making nuclear weapons. And they are not covered by the bill, EEOICPA, that program that's supposed to compensate the federal bomb makers.
So they're on the safe side of the fence, right?
Yeah, right. But because of all the sand that we raised, and also Channel 41 also had a series about the sick workers. That was tremendous. And because of that, there were several federal investigations that went on in 2010, and they actually found out that there were connecting areas between the two sides of the plant and GSA, like the ventilation systems and so forth, so they were just as exposed.
Well, this young man who came out to the meeting at IBEW Hall, there's a picture in the paper. He has a stack of papers about a foot thick, and he's still not... They keep sending him more paper all the
mm-hmm.
time. They flood you with paperwork.
Mm-hmm. And one lady's house we went out to, she had a couple of... Oh, long boxes full of papers, and she showed us, you know, she would request information about her parents' illnesses. They were both dead, but they had accidentally sent her this memo way back in the day, like, I don't know, 1970s, or it was mm-hmm. way long time ago. EPA didn't get started till 1970. So it was saying from one government office to the other, this beryllium is very damaging to people's health. And the guy sent back from the other agency, we have to do it to make nuclear weapons. And I don't think that they really meant to send her that memo.
The Kansas City article, the farmer supervisor, Maurice Copeland, was alarmed about the possibility of them demolishing that old plant. Could you talk about why he would be alarmed?
Well, the workers are looking to the plant to provide evidence of what contaminants are there, and that, you know, when they repurpose the area, it's going to destroy a lot of that evidence. They're also worried about the neighborhood being contaminated, such as there's a huge, you know, amount of beryllium there. Beryllium is a very, very light metal, and they were, you know, working with it and pulverizing it so it floats, and it can float for miles. I talked to one contractor who cleans up sites like this, and asked her how far could it, does it just fall over the side of the, you know, place and fall down right away, or does it float? So it floats for miles. So, somebody, I think it was Tom Clammer from KKFI, asked the CenterPoint representative, well, what are they going to do to keep this beryllium from floating around? And they said, well, we can wet it down first.
Oh,
But they are studying right now, they call it the Description of Current Conditions Report. There was a preliminary one released in 2013, and they're working on the final one. They're investigating what all is there and what all needs to be done to clean it up. So that should come out here in a few months.
So we've got to keep the pressure on, and I'm sorry to say we're out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel. Let's take a look back at two labor struggles that happened in the month of February. The closing down of Seattle's industries as a mere shutdown will not affect these eastern gentlemen much. They could let the whole Northwest go to pieces as far as money alone is concerned. But the closing down of the capitalistically controlled industries of Seattle, while the workers organize to feed the people, to care for the babies and the sick, to preserve order, this will move them. For this looks too much like the taking over of power by the workers. So read an editorial in a Seattle Union newspaper in 1919. On April 6th, 65,000 workers, members of 110 different AFL unions, refused to go back to work. They were joined by Japanese unions, by IWW local unions, and by numerous unorganized workers. The first general strike in North America had begun. A general strike committee composed of three delegates from each local union was established, and through it not only were the immediate concerns of the strike carried out, but city management as well. Nothing could be done without an exemption from the strike committee, and even the mayor himself sought such exemptions for necessary city services such as the hauling out of trash, the delivery of medical supplies, and the like. Commercial exemption requests were denied. Where exemptions were granted, the workers organized the services themselves. The culinary unions opened 21 large eating places where 30,000 people a day were fed. For admission to these low-cost meals, all one needed was their union card. Milk truck drivers ignored their bosses and acquired and delivered milk through worker-ran milk collection depots all over the city. To maintain order, a labor guard was established. Their only weapon was persuasion, and peace like did not exist before or after the general strike prevailed upon the shuttered city. What started as an act of solidarity for 35,000 striking shipyard workers had morphed into what the business press exclaimed was an attempt at revolution. Had the workers intended to stage a revolution, they may very well have succeeded. Instead, the General Strike Council voted to end the strike, and Seattle awoke from its six-day slumber. The rain beat heavily down in Memphis on February 1, 1968. Fighting the rain, two black garbage collectors, Echo Cole and Robert Walker, were crushed to death by a malfunctioning garbage truck. This was just the latest in a long string of abuse meted out by the city against its black workers, and on February 12th, 1,100 of the 1,300 angry and frustrated workers walked off their jobs. Their demands? Safer working conditions, better wages and benefits, and union recognition. Despite community and city council support, the mayor held fast to his refusal to negotiate. The community really took a stand behind their sanitation workers. Community organizations and churches established food and clothing banks, took up collections to pay strikers' rents, and recruited marchers for the frequent demonstrations. A local minister invited Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to join them. Dr. King was busy establishing the Poor People's Campaign for Economic Opportunity and Equality, among numerous other things, but he felt the struggle in Memphis was important. He gave a rousing speech to the strikers on March 18th and pledged to lead a march and work stoppage. On April 3rd, he gave his last speech, "I've Been to the Mountaintop." Here is an excerpt.
Now let me say as I move to my conclusion that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We've got to see it through. When we have our march, you need to be there. If it means leaving work, if it means leaving school, be there. Be concerned about your brother. You may not be on strike, but either we go up together or we go down together. Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness.
The next night, Dr. King was murdered. On April 8th, 42,000 people silently marched through Memphis in honor of Dr. King, demanding that the mayor give in to the union's requests. Negotiators finally reached a deal on April 16th, allowing the city council to recognize the union and guaranteeing a better wage. This has been Remember Our Struggle. Have a good evening.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for February 11, 2016. The Remembering Pete Seeger World Tour. Tuesday, February 16th, 6:30 p.m. Olathe Public Library, 201 East Park, Olathe, Kansas, 66061. Medicaid Expansion Lobby Day, February 17th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Meet at 201 West Capitol Avenue, Jeff City, Missouri. To RSVP, go to Jeanette@empowermissouri.org. The Right to Vote, Examining Election Law, a one-day conference at KU, Friday, February 19th, 2016, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. That's at 104 Green Hall, University of Kansas, 1535 West 15th Street, Lawrence, Kansas. A Green New Deal, How Saving the Planet Will Create Jobs and Fix the Economy, Wednesday, February 24th, 7 p.m., UMKC Student Union, 5100 Cherry, KCMO, sponsored by Jobs Now and UMKC Economics Club. Any other announcements, check out heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show.
Thanks, Molly. Okay, well, thanks for listening to our show tonight. Please tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is going to be called What's New from the Chicago Teachers and Xenophobia? Are We a Nation of Anti-Immigrants? I have been your engineer and host tonight, Jen Zaman. Judy Ansel will be joining us next week.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.